You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 26th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And a very happy birthday today to Antoine Lavoisier, the father of modern chemistry.
Happy birthday, Anton.
But what's he done for us lately?
Born on this day in 1743. That would make him 265 years old, so I hope he's listening, and happy birthday.
Happy birthday, zombie Frenchman.
And happy birthday, Evan Bernstein.
Well, that's tomorrow.
Well, that's tomorrow, so...
Or a few days ago, depending on when
you're
listening.
It'll be a few days ago. Remember, we're time traveling here.
How old are you, Evan? You're 32 or something?
32, yeah. Well, I'm still in my 30s, 39.
So again?
Well, I was born on a leap year. Oh, wait, no.
Happy future belated birthday.
Yes, thank you.
Belated birthday.
Thank you.
You just blew my mind, Bob.
We have an interview coming up with Richard Saunders, the now famous Richard Saunders from Australian TV. But first, 9/11 is back in the news.
Good, I missed it. I nearly forgot, even though all of those bumper stickers keep telling me not to.
Well, it is good.
Right. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, which has been involved in doing a lot of various analyses of the collapse of the World Trade Centers in 9/11, has just put out a report on the collapse of WT-7.
They spent 3 years doing what seems to be a very thorough, lengthy investigation into exactly what did cause World Trade Center Building Number 7 to collapse. Now, for those of you who don't recall, on September 11, 2001, terrorists hijacked some airplanes and flew them into the two tallest towers of World Trade Center, World Trade Center 1 and 2.
Yeah, for you people who were in a coma when that
did
happened.
Did you forget?
Causing them to collapse. But what some people don't remember is that later that day, I believe around 3 or 4 o'clock, the plane struck at around the 9 o'clock hour in the morning, but about 7 hours later, one of the adjacent buildings, World Trade Center 7, a 47-story office building, came crashing down. And the people who believe that 9/11 was a conspiracy engineered by our federal government have latched on to World Trade Center 7 as their smoking gun evidence that the government did, in fact, plan the entire episode. There was some sort of headquarters or operation center that things were taking place out of in World Trade Center 7 that day, and they believe that the government, as the final stroke of the plot coming off that day, is that they did a controlled explosion or implosion of the building to destroy any and all remaining evidence that might have linked the government to the deeds that day. Mm-hmm. So what the National Institute of Standards and Technology did is obviously they took a very close look at it, and they came up with the scientific evidence as to how it was fires, not explosives, not thermite, not any conscious attempt by people or government or anything to cause World Trade Center to collapse. It was a fire that basically went uncontrolled and burned for a very long time on some of the lower floors of World Trade Center 7 that caused the steel to melt and lose its support, and the whole thing came crashing
down. Just to be clear, it didn't cause the steel to melt. It caused it to weaken and bend, right?
That's right. Yeah, it wasn't like melted like liquid steel. It was just that it was severely weakened.
Yeah, it's a common claim by the conspiracy theorists that the temperatures could not burn hot enough to cause steel to melt, when in fact the steel doesn't have to melt. It just had to weaken. And in the case of World Trade Center 7, they found that it weakened on the supports were lopsided, and it weakened in such a way as to collapse on one side, which caused damage to the rest of the building.
The report reads that the heat from the uncontrolled fires caused steel floor beams and girders to thermally expand,
right,
leading to a chain of events that caused key structural columns to fail.
That's right.
You know, Evan, I heard a lot of things, more accurately, must have read a lot of things that talked about, that the building burned for a very long time. Like, the firemen didn't come and put it out. Why didn't they put it out? And then it's another one of the controlled collapse stories where, yeah, you know, it fell too perfectly and all that. And for
it might have had something to do with the fact that they were all dead because the Twin Towers had collapsed, killing hundreds of firemen. That brings up a very important point, is what is different about this incident is the duration that the fire was allowed to burn. Because typically, you know, we put the fires out before they burn for hours and hours and hours. And that you have to consider that in terms of designing these buildings. And that's kind of what the report was saying. The purpose of this was to say, you know, the recommendations that are in existence and the standards that are in existence in order to make buildings resistant to collapsing due to fires were not adequate in this situation. And what was different about the situation was the duration that the fire was allowed to burn. And, you know, you do have to realize that it's not just temperature that does damage. It's also duration. And just the amount that eventually these columns just weakened to the point where they could not support their weight.
Another factor is that the water supply to the automatic sprinkler system for the floors that were constructed in the building failed, because when World Trade Center was buildings 1 and 2 came down, that ruptured all the water supply in the entire area. There was no water to be had, in which the automatic sprinklers might have been able to either slow or, who knows, prevent.
Oh, how convenient.
Yeah, exactly.
The water sprinkles just happened to be taken out.
So, of course, as had to be expected, the 9/11 conspiracy crowd was all up in arms about this report. I'll read a couple of them to you. So the government is now able to change the laws of physics to cover its own ass. The government goes to some non-white scientist when it wants to make sure the scientist says what it wants. The FBI has hired Muslims as its top scientists. You know, and again, they're referring to the lead investigator. His name was Dr. Shyam Sunder, and you know, that's just an ethnic swipe.
Yeah, it's just naked racism thrown in there, racism, for good measure. You know.
Here's another one. The Israeli Mossad demo experts took care of it. That's why Mossad agents in the white van were there to record it. Mm-hmm. Here's someone else who says that Occam's Razor states that this report is pure BS. Interesting that they invoked Occam's Razor. And then one of my favorite ones, JFK and Governor Connally were both shot by the same 6.5-millimeter bullet, which passed right through their bodies. An incredible coincidence. Flight 800 was brought down by a spark that occurred in the center fuel tank of the 747. Dozens of witnesses, though, saw a missile fly from the area. An incredible coincidence. WTC Building 7 was brought down by limited structural damage, buried in feet of concrete and swathed in asbestos, expanded and failed due to office fires. An incredible coincidence. So there you go. You got someone who's taking three of the classic conspiracy theories in American history, tying them all together in one nice comment. So you just kind of see where these kinds of people are coming from initially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And usually if you believe in one such conspiracy theory, you believe in most or all of them. That is the typical pattern that we see. There was an interesting bit of scientific news that I actually blogged about today that I wanted to talk about, just because it's occasionally interesting to talk about real scientific controversies as opposed to the fake ones that we often spend a lot of time discussing. There was a new study published looking at the Neanderthal tool kit. So one of the burning questions still in paleontology or paleoanthropology is, why did Homo sapiens or modern humans survive and Neanderthal man not survive? You know, they died out about 28,000 years ago. We coexisted in Europe for about 10,000 or so years. Neanderthal man was there for about 360,000 years all told, but then shortly after we arrive, they die out. And so the question is, did we outcompete them? Did they go extinct for completely unrelated reasons? Did we interbreed with them, perhaps? Did we simply use up their resources? What was it that eventually drove them to extinction? One of the supporting bits of evidence for the notion that modern man outcompeted Neanderthal man was that we had a more sophisticated stone tool kit. Actually, for a long time, we shared the same tool kit, the so-called Mousterian tools, or tool industry, with Neanderthals. But then, like, Cro-Magnon man in Europe had a much more slender, more delicate stone, flintstone blade to the Neanderthals' broader one. So what these researchers did in a field called experimental archaeology is they actually spent several years learning how to make these Flintstone tools. And they made the Neanderthal-type ones and the more slender ones made by anatomically modern humans, Homo sapiens. And they to specifically address the questions, were the more slender blades a more efficient use of resources? Did they have more cutting surface? Did they last longer? Were they more durable? And what they found was that there was no advantage, that there was no advantage to the Homo sapien tools, which it just removes that argument from the notion that that was a way in which we outcompeted them or that is evidence of our inherent intellectual superiority. So the press is presenting this pretty factually, but the spin that they're putting on it, or at least the headline writers, is that Neanderthals were not as dumb as we thought they were. That this is debunking the myth of Neanderthal stupidity, which is as always is a little bit simplistic. The researchers are in their comments are sort of spinning that they're playing that as well. But actually, I didn't find that you could draw that conclusion from the data that they presented. That all you could really say is that those measures of the efficiency of these two different types of tools were not significantly different. But one thing they didn't address, which occurred to me, was, well, maybe the more slender blade worked better. Maybe it was a more efficient killing tool than the Neanderthal blade. And if you could had a higher success rate in killing your prey, then that would give you a significant edge, especially if they were competing for very few animals during a very lean winter, having a higher kill rate because your blades were better could be a significant advantage. I don't see that was addressed in the study that was done. There are also some other enduring and currently unresolved questions, the whole Neanderthal question. One is, what was the relative intelligence of Homo sapiens to Homo neanderthalensis? They had on average a larger brain than modern humans.
What does that actually mean, though? I mean, what?
Yeah, that's the question. What does it actually mean? So a larger brain does not necessarily mean more intelligence. They were more robust after all, and it doesn't say anything about the organization of their brain. If you remember at the other end of the spectrum, remember the Hobbit, the Homo florentiensis, and there was speculation that their small brains may have been, although displaying culturally the same level of intelligence and technology as modern humans, that maybe that meant that their brain had to be organized more efficiently. So perhaps their Neanderthal brains were bigger, but not as well organized as anatomically modern humans. There's also other lines of evidence that are not addressed by this kind of study. For example, there's no examples of Neanderthal art, but Cro-Magnon man left behind cave paintings and figurines and clear signs of art. They also developed very delicate artistic stone tools. They learned how to craft or were just showing off their skill by making finely crafted stone tools that were not functional. They were too delicate to actually be useful for anything. So they probably, at least for any known use that we know for them, so they probably were decorative in a way of showing off the real fine skill in crafting stone tools. Again, that's something that we don't see from the Neanderthals. And then that leads to a further question of, is this culture or raw intelligence? Does it really reflect a difference in just inherent brain power, or was this more of a cultural thing? Did we just happen to hit upon certain techniques or certain skills culturally that, again, that got passed down among Homo sapiens but not among Neanderthals? So these questions are still unresolved. It's still not really clear why we survived and they didn't. What we do know from the emerging DNA evidence is that there was very little interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals. Not none, but it was probably minimal.
And could they could have offspring, correct?
We don't know for sure.
Yeah, but would they be fertile?
I don't know that we know for sure, but it's very, very possible that they could have been fertile, yeah.
Really? Well, then, by one definition, then we'd be the same species if you could produce fertile young.
Well, but you have to actually interbreed in order to, and then to what extent. But that gets to the whole point that the demarcation between species is very fuzzy. It's what makes a species is not a very clearly delineated thing. And this is just a good example of that. In fact, there is an ongoing debate about whether or not we should be considered subspecies or different species. And the terminology has gone back and forth. Like maybe it should be Homo sapiens sapiens and Homo sapiens neanderthalensis as opposed to Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis, right? So different species or different subspecies. That's still, there are still proponents on both sides. Although I think the current consensus is that we're different species, but that's a totally fuzzy line. And because there is evidence also that we swapped some genes back and forth, but it was just minimal. It wasn't, you know, we didn't merge with them. Our populations didn't merge. That's not why they're not here, right? So that, if you're answering the question, is it possible that Neanderthals are here, that we are them, just as much as we are Cro-Magnon man, for example? That's clearly not true. We did not just merge our populations, but we did swap some genes. So anyway, cool study. I like the first time I ever read the term experimental archaeology. I think that's a good new approach. It's a different line of evidence for these kind of questions. But one more quick follow-up before we go on to some email. I think it was 2 weeks ago we talked about the quote-unquote crazy rainbow lady, as she's being referred to on YouTube and on the internet. This is the woman who has the video about the sprinklers with the rainbow pattern, the diffraction in the water, and saying that this is not natural and therefore must be a government conspiracy. And we were speculating as to where along the spectrum she falls from just someone who is scientifically illiterate, sort of going off half-cocked and making a YouTube video about their completely baseless musings, or is this somebody who has a reality problem, maybe somebody who's even diagnosable with a mental illness? Well, since that segment was posted, several of our listeners pointed out to us that this woman actually has her under a different name than the Rainbow video, has her own YouTube channel. And on that channel, there were 49 posted videos. So that's a lot more evidence now that we have in order to decide whether or not she suffers from something that could be meaningfully called a mental illness. And after viewing a lot of them, I think that I've revised my opinion in that she's almost definitely diagnosable. Have you guys seen some of her other videos now since the last show?
Yeah, she's got parts on order. There's something not right there.
Yeah. Yeah, so I wrote in the Rogues Gallery blog the other day, which unfortunately has been up and down for the last couple of weeks. We're having serious problems with our server, we're actually in the process of changing host to one that is going to be more blog friendly. So hopefully that will solve that problem. But yeah, I talked about the fact that this is often a dilemma for us. You know, we need to address wacky claims. There's a lot of people that we deal with that are somewhere along that spectrum. It's another, you know, fuzzy line. You know, we talked about the fuzzy line between species. There's definitely a fuzzy line between just being a little wacky and being diagnosable, you know. You look at somebody like Richard Hoagland, you know, the Face on Mars guy. That guy pretty much has all the features that you need to have, you know, in order to make a diagnosis of somebody who has paranoid tendencies. He's definitely somewhere along the paranoia spectrum.
Yeah, well, the thing is, when somebody's peddling something, when they're, you know, I think it's always going to be ripe for criticism if it's reaching a larger audience that needs to be told that, you know, they're wrong. But, you know, maybe they get a little less mockery if they actually require prescription medication.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, so my sort of unofficial policy has been, if I think that somebody's really mentally ill, that we just ignore them. Unless we're really forced to deal with it because, as you say, their exposure is so huge that there's no point in ignoring them. Her big thing was that everything is a government conspiracy, right? And not just a government conspiracy, but a lot of it's focused against her personally, which is that's that line that makes you think that this is something diagnosable when she thinks that it's actually, there's this personal element to it.
Steve, if you lived in a neighborhood in which you heard the same siren in every video you make, you would think the government was coming after you too.
Yeah. So she's also, I think one of the other running themes through her video is the HAARP, which is a research center in Alaska that looks, it's for studying the aurora, and they think that this is a government you know, like a black ops kind of government thing that's shooting energy waves at people and doing unethical experiments on human beings. A lot of the common theme in her videos was looking at some scientific phenomenon, completely misunderstanding it, and then assuming that it's due to some government conspiracy. So when, in one of her videos, she points out that there's Earthshine, that you could see that the unlit portion of the moon, and found that this was unexplainable, because apparently she's not aware that that's just light reflected off the Earth back to the moon. The funniest one, though, is she showed the side of her house with the horizontal slats, and it caused a moiré pattern on her low-res, you know, video camera, which is that sort of diffraction pattern that you see if you ever, like, on any low-res video of anything with parallel horizontal lines, which is, like, why you're not supposed to wear, you know, like, shirts with horizontal lines,
yeah,
if you're going to be on
TV.
And she shows the video of it, of the side of her house, and says, this is not a moiré pattern. This is government energy shooting energy waves at my house. I'm like, no, that's a moiré pattern. Look at it. It's exactly what one looks like, and it's in the conditions that create it. But that's, anyway, so but that's...
It's funny that she knew what it was, too.
Yeah, yeah. That's the other thing that struck me once I watched a bunch of her videos. Like, you know, it definitely moved further and further away from the hypothesis that she was just dumb. I actually think that she is quite bright, although uneducated. I mean, I don't think that she's very... She does not give evidence of being very well educated, but she doesn't come off sounding like a stupid person. She actually sounds like someone who's bright, but just really paranoid. Well, let's go on to an email. The first email comes from Meg Waldo from California. And Meg writes,
That's how she wrote it.
California. Meg writes, hello, skeptics. It seems you have to have an obligatory paragraph to praise for you guys to read it. No, that's not true. So, Steve, you're awesome, and I wish you were my doctor. Bob, you'll always be a physicist in our minds. Rebecca, your snarky comments warm my heart. Evan, thanks for letting us know every pointless holiday day of importance. Jay, what's up? Anyway, on to my question. I really wanted to
wait. What the hell is that?
After watching Harold and Kumar,
Steve,
she said, I think
what's
what
up,
she's
Jay?
Saying is that you're what's the down up, to earth, like cool hangout,
cool guy
member of the team.
Steve, you're awesome, and I wish you were my doctor. Jay, what's
Jay,
up?
Jay, nobody wants you to be their doctor. All right, that'd be scary. Admit it.
All right, that's fine.
What kind of doctor would Jay be?
Anyway, on to my question. I really wanted a burger from White Castle after watching Harold and Kumar, but sadly we don't have White Castle in California. So I got to wondering, is teleportation possible? That's a pretty big leap there. Are there any laws of physics that it defies, or have we just not obtained the technology yet?
Not a big
obviously.
Let's ask Neil Patrick Harris what
Neil
he
Patrick
thinks.
Harris would mount a unicorn and ride to White Castle on that.
Well, so Bob, is teleportation possible or not? Come on, level with us.
Well, when you talk teleportation, somebody's got to bring up Star Trek transporters, right? You've got to at least mention that, because that's the first thing I think of. And so I think it'd be remiss if I just didn't mention Star Trek transporters and how feasible they are. And so the key thing to realize about that kind of technology is that the amount of information and energy involved in actually teleporting somebody like that, it's just so gargantuan that you can't even wrap your mind around it. Lawrence Krauss, a physicist, determined that the amount of information in a person, if you had to encode like the position and orientation of all the atoms, you know, to the limit of the uncertainty principle, of course, he put that at like 10 to the 28 kilobits. 10 to the 28, wow. Which is something like 12 billion, billion, million megabytes. And he had a great analogy. He said a great example of how much information that actually is. If you had 10 centimeter high, 1 terabyte hard drives, that's a good size hard drive these days, 1 terabyte, 10 centimeters high, and you stacked them up, say, you know, 100 light years high, that's 10 to the 28 kilobits, apparently.
Wait. That's all that information. That's how much information it would take to disassemble a human being and reassemble them?
No, that's
a terabyte hard drive, 10, how many light years high? 100 light years high.
That's 10 to the 20. Now, people have said, well, you could compress that information. A lot of it's redundant. And fine, you probably could. But still,
Bob, what information?
The amount of information. The information, if I had to put you in a file so that I could encode you somehow and then use that information to put you back together. Basically, Jay, where every atom is or every molecule is and how they're oriented and whatever, all this little information you need if I had to rebuild you.
Wow.
That's the kind of information I would need.
Oh, my God.
The other thing that occurs to me, I mean, obviously this is that's a non-trivial problem, the amount of information necessary. But you think, is there any way to mitigate it a little bit? And again, what if you the compressibility question comes up, not just compressing the data, but also, like, you know, does every atom doesn't have to be in exactly in the same place. You can just sort of approximate it. Like, you could say a skin cell goes here, but it doesn't necessarily have to be exactly, you know, the skin
right.
cell that's there already.
That's
the only
true.
Thing that I would really want to get as accurate as possible would be
it's
my brain.
Yeah, but
right.
then you bring up continuity as well, because if you disassemble someone, turn them into a mist of atoms, and use some type of magnetics to move that mist from point A to point B and put it back together, in my opinion, you're breaching continuity and you're rebuilding a different person.
Yeah, so the original person is dead. Mm-hmm. And now you have a new person whose existence is starting at that moment. Right.
But aside from that, right, but aside from that, all those other concerns, it's just the technology required to deal with this. And it's not even just the pure information content, because even if it's just the brain, Steve, if you just had to encode the brain to sufficient detail, okay, it's not 10 to the 28 kilobits. Maybe it's 10 to the 18 or 10 to the 22. Still huge, huge, gargantuan stuff that we can't even imagine a technology dealing with it. But
yeah.
It's not just the amount of the information. How about storing that information? Another example Krauss came up with was that if you could store this information that you gather, that you're gathering, at 10 gigabytes a second, it would take 14 times the age of the universe to store, just to store this information.
Mm-hmm. You get a lot of bandwidth.
Okay, all right. Now let's talk about bringing the burgers to us. A little easier.
That'd be a lot easier.
Well, one more, though. One more example, though, just real quick. Just if you turn somebody to energy, we're talking a gigaton, like a gigaton nuke going off. Like a billion tons of TNT. So good luck safely dealing with that much energy. But besides all that, I assume, Meg, what Meg's talking about in terms of teleportation is quantum teleportation. Experiments that are in the news every few years, it seems like, oh, here's another quantum teleportation experiment that's been carried out. And they're really fascinating. I'll try to be quick on this. The idea with quantum teleportation is it's very important to understand what entanglement is. Because quantum teleportation uses entanglement to carry is the meat, the beef of this experiment is entanglement. If you don't have entanglement, it's not going to happen. And entanglement is basically a phenomena of quantum mechanics in which two particles become so associated that they are actually they're integrated in such a way that you can't explain one fully without resorting to the other one. So they become one unit in a sense, even if they are separated by a billion light years. If there's a billion light years between them, there's some sort of weird connection between them that links them together, making them really one unit. If you measure one and it becomes spin up, then the other one would automatically have to be spin down. They've got some complementary relationship in some way that's kind of hard to explain. And it's important to say, though, regarding that, though, that this people say that, you know, there's this spooky action at a distance, and that's what Einstein had his famous problem with, calling it spooky action at a distance. There seems to be some sort of link between these two, but there's no way that you can build a communication device around this, because this is random information. There's no way to encode information in this. So that's important, because people will throw that at you all the
time. But Bob, isn't this all speculation as well?
No, these experiments have been carried out. There's no question about any of this stuff, quantum entanglement, the teleportation, all this stuff.
Man, I will never, ever get entanglement. I'll never get all of that level of stuff. I read about it, and it's like, you know, I get the surfacey thing, but I can't wrap my head around it.
It's one of the most bizarre aspects of the most bizarre theory out there, so don't feel bad about that. So
just watch Jeff Goldblum in The Fly. You'll get it.
Right. So what they do, in a nutshell, they're entangling particles together in order to teleport the quantum state of one object, of one particle, to another particle that's separated, either by 10 miles or a billion. It doesn't matter. So that's what they're doing. They're entangling particles together in such a way with each other that they can teleport the state of one to the other.
But because you can't transfer the information with this, and that's been shown so far in every experiment, this is not going to get us White Castle hamburgers.
No, I mean, guys, right. the only way that humans are going to teleport, in my opinion, is if we're in the Matrix. And then physics just goes out the window. We could do whatever we want.
Well, Jay, as bizarre as this sounds, though, according to a lot of people I've read, they're not. And the bottom line, Meg, is what I'm getting to here is I'll throw some quotes at you from some famous physicists like Lawrence Krauss. He said that someday we may figure out ways to make classical systems behave quantum mechanically. Wow, that would be pretty amazing. But he says, but there's a big difference in declaring something possible and then making it practical. Transporting anything other than a particle is extremely implausible. So he's saying it's implausible, although he's not saying that it's actually violating any hard and fast rules of physics. Michio Kaku, a theoretical physicist, and actually he's hosting a new show on the Science Channel called Visions of the Future. It looks pretty cool. He says there's nothing in principle to prevent us from teleporting an actual person, but the technical problems are staggering, obviously. He said it could be centuries or longer before everyday objects are teleported, if it's possible at all. So they're pretty much both agreeing that there's really nothing, it's not violating any obvious rules, laws of physics, but it's just impossible.
It's all
bullshit.
The practicalities and... Right, and stop if we talking. See it, I think we may see something like that in the future, but it'll be like post-singularity tech. It's not going to be anything.
Post-singularity tech. Has that phrase been coined yet, Bob?
Just coined it.
I don't think so.
Bob, that's PST, man. That's all PST.
Bob, like what about it, opening up a wormhole?
I was going to ask that question. Forget about teleportation.
How about a can of wormholes?
We'll just go through a wormhole.
The problem with that is that you would need a Jupiter-sized amount of negative energy, which is... negative matter, which is only completely theoretical and never even been shown to exist. So you'd have to produce this theoretical matter that no one knows if it even exists, and then get a Jupiter level quantity of it to keep open the mouth of the wormhole. But then you're good,
and then we can have hamburgers.
Bob, in the time that it took for you to explain all that to us, Rebecca walked to get her little freaking hamburgers from
I actually castle. Have them already in front of me.
Good. How are they, Rebecca?
I don't know. I'm a vegetarian. Shit.
Are they full of chupacabra goodiness?
Well, thanks, Meg. And thanks for that explanation, Bob. But let's go on to our interview. We're sitting here now with Richard Saunders of the Australian Skeptics and the Tank Podcast. Richard, welcome back to the Skeptics Guy.
Thank you, and it's great to be here in person. And also from the Mystery Investigators Science Show for Schools.
That's where you're putting most of your efforts now. I was going to talk to you about that.
Well, my efforts are spread all around the place. Where I have the most fun, I think would be in the schools, yeah.
Tell us about that project.
That's where we go into high schools and elementary schools, and we do various things like water divining, water dowsing tests, or we have a real bed of nails. And when the kids lie on the bed of nails or the teachers lie on the bed of nails, it's a great reaction.
Like they go, ah!
They do. Now, insurance. And this is true. We had to get $6 million worth of insurance before we could set foot in a school and do our show.
What does that cost?
It's not too bad, actually. It's only $400 or $500 or something like that. But I'm thinking, what do they think we're going to do? Burn the school down?
Yeah.
Right.
Kill
yeah.
every kid
or
in the class?
Pound them into the bed of nails, maybe?
Yeah. But that's, really enjoyable because the kids have a ball. Because the first thing we do is we bend a spoon, and they've never seen that. And then we say, who's heard of the Loch Ness Monster? All the kids have heard of the Loch Ness Monster. Who's heard of UFOs, Bigfoot? This is the stuff from the 70s, and the kids still know about
it. Yeah, they sure do.
It's infused into our culture, the world culture.
It is.
Right?
Well, really English-speaking, at least.
And so you don't you don't just go in and tell them it's all crap. You teach them how to think is the idea,
We
right?
try to. Yeah, we don't say all these things we've just shown you on the screen, they're all rubbish. We say, these are the things we investigate. Are they true? And we're going to look at some others now and show you how you can do it for yourself. And then we just take the show from there.
it's not just so you've got mystery investigators,
yeah,
and then you've got a good acting career going on, right?
Actually, that's come to an end now.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, I was for a couple of years, for more fun than anything else, a background actor,
yeah,
in lots of TV shows.
Like, you pretended to be a tree.
I did. Or a grassy knoll.
you were person number three in the restaurant in the corner, yeah, right?
Well, when the movie, the new movie called Australia comes out with Hugh Jackman and Nicole Kidman and heaps of other great big stars, you'll see me, I'm in an outside ball in the middle of World War II, and I'm like a British officer, brigadier. Yeah. And Hugh Jackman sort of gives me a funny look, and off he goes. And so that was a good
fun. You got a funny look from Hugh Jackman.
From Wolverine, yeah.
From Wolverine. Nicole Kidman winked at me.
Oh, my God. Forget it.
And now, I told my wife that.
Jay, take it easy. Hold on.
My wife said, the hussy.
What?
The hussy.
Let me ask you a question.
Wait, whoa.
I'm asking him a question about Nicole Kidman.
Former Mrs. Tom Cruise.
just tell me, man. How hot is she?
Well, that was going to be my question.
Oh, my God.
Like, ridiculous. Is
that
it,
says
like,
it all.
Is it
all.
Ridiculous?
You guys,
wait.
No.
Shut it.
We suffer through your marriage proposal.
No,
don't let us get this question
We need to get back
in.
To the important things, like how hot Hugh Jackman is.
Let me ask it this way, too, because I wanted to know that. But the couple of times when I've met in person, you know, gorgeous women who are on TV, they're always 100 times more gorgeous in person than you think they are on television. Is that your experience?
With Nicole Kidman, as gorgeous as she is on the screen, in real life, she's like you say.
Yeah,
she's angelic.
Yeah, angelic. But yeah, she is a complete professional. So on the set, she was so focused on what she had to do that, Hugh Jackman's I'm sure equally as professional, but he'll have a word with you or say how you're going and sit down and whatever, and then get back into his character. But Nicole Kidman's concentration on what she has to do. So I respect them both. Yeah.
Oh, God.
That segues into you have a show coming out.
That's right. The reason why I'm not going to be doing the background stuff anymore is because I'll be simply too famous in Australia to be a background character.
It's true. You're going to be. Yeah. You're going to be huge.
I'm going to be a skeptical judge on a show called The One, The Search for Australia's Greatest Psychic.
That's fun. That's going to be fun.
I can't say whether we have, you know, what level of psychics we've actually found, but I'm on the show and I'm going to be having a look to see what they do and offering my point of view. And
is that kind of like The Search for Bigfoot, though?
In a way, I guess.
Well, I guess so, yeah.
Well, no, because, I mean, it's The Search for the Greatest Psychic, right? So, I mean, the greatest psychic, I mean, surely someone must be the superlative of even something that doesn't exist, right?
Yeah. True.
Well, so is this a Australian version of the American show, The Phenomenon? Is that your
choice? I've seen the American one. This is a little different. It's certainly a lot more, it's a very good-natured show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
so you're not the Simon Cowell of the show? Or is it?
In a way, yeah. I get booed a little bit.
Do you have to affect a British accent, or they'll let you keep your Australian accent?
No, they'll
let me
keep this one.
Can
fine.
You affect a British accent?
No.
Okay, don't even try.
I'm not going to even go there. I can do an Australian accent.
Oh, let's hear it.
Crikey!
Aluminium.
Just say aluminium.
Aluminium. I was going to do on stage, when they said, come to TAM, I thought, great, what am I going to talk about? And I looked at my timing, half an hour, oh, what do I leave out? Was the
yeah,
thing.
Right.
So I was going to do a routine where I channeled Steve Irwin. Mm-hmm. And in Australia, we've got something called, we've got many snakes, as you might know, and they're all
mostly deadly. Mostly 85% deadly.
And we have a brown snake. So I was going to go, crikey, you know, we've got the Sylvia brown snake here. This is the only snake with claws. It's amazing. But I didn't.
Oh. But you did it just now. So
I did it just now. Excellent. But no, half an hour. So I thought, what do I do? I mean, I normally talk for an hour and the questions and whatever. So I talked about the fact that I made the origami Pegasus, which is great fun, and a few other things. And I thought the best use I could put for my time is to talk to the teachers, especially in the audience, about one of the demonstrations we do back in Australia, which works very well. And that was the water divining, which shows a double blind test. And I think it did. Teachers were coming up to me and other people afterwards saying that they really appreciated that.
Oh, cool.
And that's the kind of the stuff you do also with the detectives you do in the schools.
The mystery investigators.
Yeah, mystery investigators.
Absolutely out of the show we do in the schools. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You find you get a good response from that?
An excellent response. Yeah, the teachers come and say, yeah, thank you for that. I'm sure some of the teachers didn't know what a double blind test was before we do the before that.
Yeah.
I mean, when I graduated high school, I didn't have a clear understanding about what a double blind test yet. It's one of the bedrocks of science, you know.
Mm-hmm. So many things vanish when you simply just blind it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so the believers don't do them anymore because they don't work.
And then they say you can't test psychics that way or something like that.
Yeah, right. That's exactly. I love the one where they're like, well, if there's a skeptic in the room, the negative energy from the skeptic is blocking the psychic ability.
I've had that in the past. I've had that absolutely happen to me in the past, saying, well, we can't read you, for example, when I've gone for a psychic reading because you're negative and closed. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm really open. I really want to know. But you're doing this, 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 and this.
I think that's why you're so successful doing, you know, the tank and all of that, is because you have a really upbeat, positive attitude. And I know I've said this before, but I'll say it again because it's true. I think you do us a really great service by being a cheery skeptic.
Well, what? Thank you.
Yeah, how do you fake that?
Yeah, because I know that you're actually full of hate.
He's a great actor, obviously.
It's true.
Thank you very much. What it does, apart from hopefully putting a fun side to thing, is it. We have an expression at wrong foot somebody. I don't know if you're familiar with
that
expression.
New to me. Wrong.
I think it comes from cricket, where if the batsman's standing in the incorrect way when the ball comes, he's not sure what to do. So if you wrong foot your opponent, they're off balance.
Yeah.
That's what I might say. So and you probably get this yourself, people think that a skeptic is a naysayer, negative,
cynic.
I won't believe anything you say.
Yeah,
I come along and say, yeah, it would really be great. What can you do? Let's have a look. I'm really fascinated. Let's see. Huh? What?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're not a skeptic. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a skeptical attitude. So
right.
Yeah, they expect a curmudgeon.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Or a cynic.
And that, I do the same thing. I agree. Like when I went to give a talk, I was part of a debate in front of an audience full of homeopaths. Mm. And I didn't have two heads and fangs. And like, wow, you're like, you know,
so that stuff's
reasonable.
But then what happens? then what happens? Like, oh, you must be the exception.
Yeah, you're the exception.
Yes, I get that too.
No, we're actually all pretty nice.
One of the reasons I was asked to appear on this new show is I appear on other TV shows back home as the skeptic, the morning shows like Today and Sunrise or whatever you have here.
Mm.
And I'll be on, it'll be me and a ghost hunter, or me and a crop circle person, or whatever the case may be. And the producers, I put them on YouTube for some strange reason so people can see. And the producers saw the one with me and the ghost tour lady. And I'm, you know, friendly and saying, yeah, I'd love to come on your tour and look for ghosts. Doesn't sound like fun. I don't think they're real, but let's have a look. So they're thinking, what the hell is this? This can't be a skeptic. And they called me in for a meeting and,
So, Dan, what's the matter with you here? Right? Like, why are you being nice to these people?
Yeah.
We expected an asshole and you're too nice.
That's right. Well, they wanted somebody nice on the show. They didn't want someone to put down the psychics.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I try not to
do. Sounds like you got recruited for this new show that you're doing by being nice.
Oh, I thought they wanted you to be the bad guy on the show so they can...
I am the bad guy regardless because I'm not a believer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's easy. I mean, there are seven contestants, all of whom claim to be psychic. My co-panelist is a witch.
Mm-hmm.
The host is officially on the fence.
A witch.
So can I just ask, I know you can't go into too much detail about the show, but I'm wondering if you can tell us, I mean, is the idea that at the end of the show, one of those seven is declared a winner?
Yes, one of them will be declared a winner, and that will be voted by the Australian public.
Well, do you worry that that's going to lend legitimacy to that person?
Well, all I can say is if they are truly psychic, I will also support them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And if they're not, though?
If they're not, and who knows, because we're still making the show, who knows? Mm-hmm. If not, then I'm under no obligation to declare the winner also a psychic. Okay. I can simply say Australia have voted you as the popular vote. Congratulations, which I will do, of course. You know,
right. Mm-hmm.
Tallest midget. Right.
And also, you know, the TV show is doing its thing, but you still get to have a skeptical voice.
Yes.
And it seems from what you said, they're not going to paint you as, you know, the side guy. You're going to legitimately have your say, and they're going to play it.
We'll see how it's edited, but they're a great group of producers to work with, and they wouldn't want to paint me paint me out of the picture. They need that conflict almost.
But you haven't seen an edited episode yet.
No, I have not.
You really have no idea then how they're going to edit it.
I'm sure they'll be quite fair.
Okay. Yeah. It's interesting to me because I feel like it's almost like you're working with the enemy because and you know, this is just my feeling on it, is that the idea of the show, I don't really like the idea of the show itself. I think that it's a bad idea to lend that sort of legitimacy to a psychic, and not that you would be doing that, but I do think it's kind of a good thing though that you're stepping in that role just to at least lend that skeptical voice. Do you have any conflicts about it?
Oh, not really. I think the pluses really do outweigh the minuses in this situation. My fear was that if I had turned down the show, they would get somebody who calls themselves a skeptic to go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And after so many years in the game now and reading all the books and studying all the videos and going to many, many psychics, I know what the hell I'm talking about. Yep. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I don't hope that sounds egotistical, but I really know.
Well, no, that's our job. Understand that stuff, right?
You know, it'd be scary to, you know, we know of a few people who call themselves skeptics and they're nothing like that. And you're right. It would be horrible if one of those people got on there because it would just be pandering to everything.
Could you imagine this is welcome to the show. We've got Fred Bloggs here, who's the skeptic. And we see something on the screen from one of our contestants, which I may consider to be not particularly psychic, where Fred Bloggs, not with the knowledge, would say, oh, I don't know how that worked. That's incredible. Gee, maybe they're psychic. And I'd be going at home going, oh no.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you again.
Well, we are back now with Richard Saunders. Richard, thanks for talking with us again.
Hello.
So our listeners have just listened to the interview that we did at TAM 6 a couple of months ago, and we said that after your show, The One, aired, that we would watch it and we would sit down and talk with you about how it went. So how did it go?
Well, from my point of view, it was a mixed bag. First of all, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of stress. It was a lot of hard work. And I was tearing my hair out and having a good time at the same time. So I'm still a little confused about it all.
Yeah.
Well, did you find a psychic? That's what everybody's on the edge of their seats about.
They're on the edge of their seats? Oh, I better tell everybody then.
Make it good. No? I am shocked.
There was a woman who walked to the kid in the sleeping bag.
Well, I mean, apart from her, of course. No, I mean, everyone says, was there a one? Well, yes, technically there was a one. There was somebody that Australia was told, vote for these three people, one of them will win. And they voted and somebody won the show. Great, fine, congratulations. It doesn't mean they're psychic. They simply won a popularity contest on a fun TV show. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like our presidential election coming up.
Enough with the small talk. Did the show cheat? Because when I watched about three episodes, it sure as hell seemed to me that they were cheating left and right.
Okay, the answer to that is, to the best of my knowledge and as far as I could see and participate, no. However, the show was edited, as any show is edited, and I was not involved in any way, shape, or form in the editing process. I can say, though, some of the studio days went to 6, 7, 8 hours long. We filmed a hell of a lot of readings, and it was all edited. Now, if you're the editor of a show like this, which is the premise is that there are psychics and we're going to show you psychics, and you have a 10-20 minute reading, you've got some hits in the reading and a lot of misses. Well, of course, I think you're going to edit out most of the misses. But again, any show is heavily edited.
When you saw the edited version of what happened, were you surprised? Do you feel like they misrepresented anything that you said? Or, I don't know, what did you think of it?
Not exactly. I shouldn't have been too surprised. I was a little surprised because I never knew what they would leave in and what they would leave out, especially with my comments. I made a lot of comments during the taping of the show. They'd ask me frequently, what did you think of this? What did you think of that? And I thought myself a couple of times, I just nailed what was really happening. A little bit of that they chose to show and a lot was cut out. My co-judge, Stacey DeMarco, the same applied to her. She made many, 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 many comments. A lot was simply left on the cutting room floor. Just part of the process of making a TV show.
Let me make a couple observations, Richard. So just for a little bit of background for the audience, these shows were aired only in Australia. How many episodes were there total?
5 episodes.
5, okay. I saw 4 of them on YouTube. For some reason, I didn't come across the 5th one, but they're all on YouTube, I suppose. If you look at the whole show together, the 7 psychics that were being tested, I didn't have the reaction that Jay did. Of course, every now and then I thought, you know, did they allow a little cheat to slip through there? But I thought basically they didn't have to do that. Obviously, I figured there was a lot of editing going on. It's clear they were doing editing because, for example, they would have the 7 psychics do the medical reading to the 6 people, and they wouldn't show everyone's reading of each person. So obviously, they were selecting the few that they showed. But taken as a whole, it seemed like they did pretty poorly. That the readings in general to me seemed like pretty standard textbook and actually rather lame cold readings. And their guesses were high probability guesses. They were very scattershot. They did all the cold reading techniques of trying to maximize their hit potential, very vague generalizations, a point that they did allow you to make several times. And that it also wasn't the same person hitting every time. So just like you would expect from chance, on one test, one psychic would get lucky. On another test, another psychic would get lucky. And on a third test, the third psychic would get lucky. But there was no pattern to any of it. So if you look at the whole thing, it's like a big meta experiment. It was a bunch of lame cold reading and a lot of misses and random hits. Do you agree with that assessment?
I think that is a very good and fair assessment, especially having been in my position where I saw much more than the home viewer or the YouTube viewer will ever see. And that's how I called it on the show. A lot of my comments were along the lines of, well, when you make a lot of guesses, some of them are bound to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it looked a bit strange when I made those sort of comments on the show because what the viewer was shown was edited more towards, you know, making the psychics look favorable.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view, and I said it right to the last episode, I said I did not see any evidence of paranormal activity.
But as you just said, that you were making those comments based upon what you were seeing during the taping, but the TV audience didn't see all of that. Do you feel that made you out to look like the naysayer or the denier because you were holding fast to a skeptical attitude, but the audience was being showed a very positively skewed editing of what you were assessing?
I think that's not an unfair comment. I think that would have happened regardless. I get people coming up to me in the street in Australia now, mostly people who are into the paranormal asking me how I could be so negative on the show or such a bad guy. And I'm a bit perplexed about that because I really tried to be level-headed and fair and just called it as I saw it. I didn't say anything rude or insulting or bad. So to a large section of the audience, it wouldn't have made any difference what they were seeing and my comments. They would have still painted me as the villain. But to the skeptical community, they can obviously see I was trying to be level-headed and fair and keep my temper.
Definitely.
So, okay, some respect, I wasn't in a winning situation, but to the skeptical or the thinking audience, I think they could see where I was coming from.
Richard, did you actually get time with the other co-hosts to talk about the psychics and actually have dialogue with her about who should get voted off?
Absolutely. That's one of the things about the show that was true. At the end of the episode in the studio, Stacy, my co-judge, and I would run backstage to this funny little corner, and it would take us a long time. And one of the questions I put to the producers early on when they were pitching the idea to me, they said, and at the end of the show, you'll score them on psychic ability to see who leaves the show. And I said, I don't understand. What am I going to be scoring them on? Psychic ability? So at the end of the day, all I could do was score them on how well they did, how well they did in the challenges. But it was Stacy and I who decided who left the show. It wasn't rigged at all.
Why did you invite, why did you vote off Mitchell on the first round? Because from my perspective was that he actually did pretty good. He seemed to be very good at cold reading.
Okay, then that is a little difficult because Stacy and I would have been having our discussions based on everything we saw in the studio. And if that's not what translated to what the home viewer saw, well, there you go. We were also trying to judge on how well they did on the external tests. Now, those people who have seen the show, our contestants went out and they looked for a lost boy in the bush. They looked for the bones of Ned Kelly, the famous bushranger outlaw. But what a lot of people forget, they had something like a 94% failure rate on those external tests. In fact, the first episode was the last time any of them got the mark.
And that was the one with finding the boy, right, in the woods?
The one with finding the boy, yeah.
With 2 of 7 found it. And you actually, when the first one found it, it was just under 15 minutes. And that was like one of the best comments you were able to make, or that they showed on TV. Where you said, mm-hmm. Well, I think he found him by just running around the woods for 15 minutes. You know,
yeah,
he wasn't
covered a lot of territory.
Not
in
being
a short
psychically
amount of time.
drawn to him.
And I get back to the point I make frequently. This show was in no way meant to be a serious scientific examinations of claims of the paranormal. It was devised for entertainment, so the tests were not scientific. They were produced so they looked good on film, and there was a bit of drama and action and what'll happen next,
right,
sort of thing.
Well, Richard, I noticed that during that first test, they did specifically say that, you know, you were there to oversee exactly like where the boy was being hidden and what the controls would be. Did you actually have input into the controls?
I did. I had input into the... Well, what happened was the producers would come up with a test like the boy lost in the bush or the hunt for the bones or whatever it might be, and they'd run it by me. And in many cases, I was able to introduce some protocols like randomization or making sure the contestants didn't talk to each other, basic protocols. But at some point, my introduction of scientific protocols had to come to an end because, for example, they were using the same film crew again and again and again. This was
I
mean, they couldn't use 7 different film crews. It was just out of the question. Again, that just comes back to the fact it wasn't a proper scientific test. There were tests for entertainment, for television.
Well, Richard, you must have had some expectations going into this project, and you obviously went through with it. And coming out the other end, is it about what you thought it would be, or were you surprised on certain aspects of it?
Of course, I would have hoped it would have had more of my comments about what was what I saw in the studio. The more the show progressed, the more I realized that it was angled towards a promotion of the paranormal. And yes, it was a little difficult for me because I would have certainly wished it to be a bit more balanced, if I might put it that way. But other people have been in this situation. Banachek has been in this sort of situation. Joe Nickell finds himself in this situation from time to time. I can't be too angry about it because I went in with my eyes open. But on the positive side, we've had a lot of interest in Australia for Australian skeptics because of my appearance on the show.
And that was going to be my follow-up question is, do you feel by participating in this that you've advanced the cause of skepticism overall?
Oh, absolutely, because if I wasn't in the show, then it would have either gone out without a skeptical voice, and then I would have been crying under my bed thinking, why didn't I go on the show? Or worse yet, it would have gone out with somebody who thinks they're a skeptic.
But you don't feel like you've been maybe used at all by a significant, you know, by producers and everyone who are believers in psychic ability in the paranormal?
Quite possibly. Sure, why not? Yeah, but I don't feel too angry about it because, again, well, look, I have been also using that TV show to put out the message there are people called Australian skeptics, and I've got to mention cold reading, and I put some obvious points across, so I've got to take that as a plus.
All kidding aside, you did look very good on the show. You have a very good TV appearance.
Oh, shucks.
You
persona.
Are a persona.
You definitely comported yourself quite well, and that's shown through, definitely.
I was almost in a way rooting for you every time you came on. I just wanted you to stand up and say it like it is, and I know that you really couldn't do that, but I was just dying to see that. But either way, you looked great. It was a lot of fun watching you do it, and I think it really was a good opportunity.
Well, thank you. I'm never going to pretend that it was a complete success for skeptics and it was the best thing ever, and look, we've made it now. Absolutely not. The believers in this audience at home and in the studio keep right on believing. The skeptics can see clearly what was going on with editing and cold reading. But what it meant, I think, at the end of the day, is more people have heard, there's a group called Australian Skeptics, Google, 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 whatever. They can look us up. And I did a very interesting
interview with a group called Ghost Radio in Australia. And this is on the Skeptics homepage, www.skeptics.com.au, where I talk even a bit more about some of the background goings on. But that was a good opportunity for me to go onto a paranormal show and put the skeptical point of view. So there are minuses, to be sure, but I think they are outweighed by the pluses.
Well, Richard, thanks for talking with us some more, and congratulations on the whole show.
Thank you again. Again, please, I would encourage people to visit skeptics.com.au and find out more about Australian Skeptics, or mysteryinvestigators.com.
Hey, Richard, I can now say that you're one of my favorite TV personalities.
All right, Richard, thanks again for talking with us. Take care.
Thanks, SGU, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this challenge?
I like grapes.
I think we're ready.
Okay. You're always ready. Here we go. Item number one. A new study shows that while wind turbines are a major hazard for birds, they pose little to no risk for bats. Item number two, scientists have developed a new technique that can identify fingerprints on a bomb even after it has exploded, and even if the prints were previously washed off. And item number three, a newly published study finds that more than 20% of quote-unquote Ayurvedic medicines sold on the internet contain unsafe levels of lead, mercury, or arsenic. Jay, go first.
A new study shows that while wind turbines are a major hazard for birds, they pose little to no risk for bats. That makes sense to me, because if bats have a pronounced sense of hearing and with their echolocation and all that, I think they probably would be able to kind of visualize at night, particularly where the turbine is, and not get in the way. That seems to make sense. Number two, scientists have developed a new technique that can identify fingerprints on a bomb even after it has exploded, even if the prints were previously washed off. Well, that's interesting. Okay, so some dude has a bomb. The bomb goes off. There's still pieces of metal or debris around. They pick it up. They scan it for fingerprints with some new methodology. And even if the guy tried to wipe them off or whatever, they could still find it. There's some residue that's left there. Seems possible. The last one, newly published study finds that more than 20% of Ayurvedic medicines sold on the internet contain unsafe levels of lead, mercury, or arsenic. So, Steve, what are those types of medicines?
It's basically Indian folk medicine.
From India?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Okay. Okay. This is another thing. Like, sure, why wouldn't I believe that? That makes sense. What's the most deadly of those three, Steve?
Arsenic.
You're just totaled if you come in physical contact with that. You're totaled.
How could that
right?
be? It's natural.
It's all yeah. natural. All
it's
natural
good for
mercury.
You.
Yeah. They're all bad, but probably I would say arsenic, then mercury, then lead, and if you want to put them in order of toxicity.
For my own reasons, Rebecca, I'm going to select the second one, the one about the bomb and the fingerprints. I'm going to select that as the fake. I have my own internal feelings on this.
Uh-huh. So that's, did your psychic advisor tell you to go with that one? Or?
Remember that lady? Oh, my God. I'm talking to Frank now. Hi, Frank. Yes, which one should I pick? One, two, or three? Oh, you say four, but they're okay. Thank you. Right. I go with two.
All right, Bob.
The new technique to identify fingerprints on a bomb, after it's exploded, and after the prints were wiped off. Wow. That's impressive stuff. But what they could do with forensics technology, it's so amazing. It's not... still, that doesn't sound too plausible, but possible. The Ayurvedic medicines on the internet, that's just... Yeah, 20% are prepared inappropriately. Sure. I could buy that, absolutely. Something about the wind turbines, though, major hazard for birds, but little to no risk for bats. I could see the bats, though, having a trouble detecting such big turbines spinning. I think they'd have trouble actually detecting that. I could see it actually being a problem for bats. I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Evan?
Those Indian medicines, yeah, that's scary stuff, and it's just sounds very unfortunately plausible. So I think that one is correct. The new technique that can identify fingerprints on a bomb after it exploded, previously washed off. Didn't we see something like that? The new Batman movie, in which, you know, a casing of a gun is shot, or the bullet is shot, and the fragments are reconstructed, and they take the pieces of the fingerprints off of the fragments and to create one fingerprint. So,
yeah, but they didn't wash it. The Joker didn't wash it. His fingerprints off first.
We don't know. They didn't establish that. So the point being is that there's technologies to make improvements on this kind of thing, and I think it's plausible. My issue I have with the ones birds and bats is that there's two parts to this question, how you phrased it, Steve. New studies show that while turbines are a major hazard for birds, they pose little to no risk for bats. So there's really two parts there. Is it really a major hazard for birds? As compared to no risk for bats, or can it go the other way, or vice versa? I think how that one is structured lends itself a little bit to tipping its hand. That one is probably fiction. Plus, I think perhaps the reason why it would be a risk for bats is the echolocation and these wind turbines. I mean, they put out all kinds of frequencies and so forth, and I would guess that could possibly drive bats, you know, really,
batty.
Really wild or crazy. So
batty.
I'm going to go with birds and bats. That one's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, so you could have said that more than 20% of any medicine sold on the internet contains rat balls, and I would have believed you. So I'm pretty sure that's true. New technique that can identify fingerprints on a bomb. That doesn't seem very new to me. I feel like I've read about previous efforts with that in the past, so that's plausible, even though it is remarkable. And item one, unless this is some shocking new large study that says otherwise, I'm under the impression that wind turbines are not a major hazard for birds. That's why, you know, they're up all over the place. You just have to plan it out around birds' migratory schedules. So I'm going to say that one's the fiction, though. I'm not sure why they would pose little to no risk for bats, because I do think the echolocation would help them, but maybe because their migratory patterns aren't as normal as birds. I don't know. But that's probably the fiction, anyway.
All righty. So you all agree that a newly published study finds that more than 20% of Ayurvedic medicines sold on the internet contain unsafe levels of lead, mercury, or arsenic. You all agree that one is science.
Although I hope it's fiction.
That one is, in fact, science. Although, on previous and recent weeks, you guys have put forward the argument that the one that's the most obviously true is probably the fiction. But this week you didn't do that. You all agreed that it was obviously true, therefore it was true.
It's two, yeah.
That's because we all knew there was one that was obviously false.
Ah.
Which trumps the one that's obviously true being false.
I see. This was a study published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. And if you read the studies, there's nothing I could do about that. they actually purchased medicines on the internet and then tested them for levels of heavy metals, which are toxins in a sufficient dose. And they found that 20.7% showed unsafe levels of these metals. They said some of them contained lead and or mercury ingestions 100 times to 10,000 times greater than the acceptable limits.
Oh, my Whoa. God.
That's a lot. That's not just a little bit over. 10,000 times is a lot. And there actually have been cases of lead poisoning and heavy metal poisoning in India among people using these. And what I didn't know until I read the study is that there is a tradition within Ayurvedic medicine called Rasa Shastra that believes that deliberately adds heavy metals to herbal remedies because that's part of the medicine.
Yeah.
So it's not just a contaminant. Sometimes it's actually deliberate. It's actually that's the philosophy of healing that they're going with, that you got to activate the herbs with these heavy metals.
And the poison people, yeah.
Yeah. I'd much rather take a homeopathic remedy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
me too.
And they found that among the items tested, the ones that were labeled as, you know, Rasa Shastra had more heavy metals in them, which makes sense. But a lot of the non ones did too, so it wasn't limited to that. It wasn't just among the products that were advertised that way.
So, Steve, to clarify, are you saying that they are actually adding arsenic to their medications?
Yeah, sometimes. That's right.
It's all natural.
God, why don't they just buy a chemistry book?
The study also refers to the fact that a 2005 Institute of Medicine report concluded that the regulatory mechanisms for monitoring the safety of dietary supplements should be revised. The constraints imposed on FDA with regard to ensuring the absence of unreasonable risk associated with the use of dietary supplements make it difficult for the health of the American public to be adequately protected. Gee, that sounds awfully familiar. So the regulations for supplements are completely inadequate, and this is just one manifestation of that. So, Jay, you're all by your lonesome in thinking that number two is science, that scientists have developed a new tech, is fiction rather, yeah, that scientists have developed a new technique that can identify fingerprints on a bomb even after it has exploded, even if the prints were previously washed off.
Yeah.
And that one is science.
Yeah.
But of course.
That was amazing. That was a very interesting study. I was surprised, but I immediately thought of the Batman scene where they reconstruct the blood. Because I remember watching the Batman movie, thinking, "Wow, that's kind of implausible." You know, that you could take these fragments off of a bullet and reconstruct a fingerprint off of it. But apparently, they can do it. That's not, that's actual science.
Steve, can I have a moment right now, real quick?
Yeah,
Meg from California, answer your question. What's up? I just lost science or fiction.
Right. So,
why is that implausible?
Well, it just seems really difficult that you would get off the pieces, the tiny pieces of fragments of metal that you'd be able to reconstruct a fingerprint. But they can do it. They can visualize the fingerprints. But also, it incorporates a technique. So it looks at the way in which fingerprints corrode metal surfaces. So there could be very subtle corrosion. You can't wash off. That's things. Even if you wash the actual prints off,
right,
it left its imprint on the metal itself.
So the sebum, which comes out of our skin, actually corrodes some metals?
Apparently.
That's,
and then they coat it. They coat the fragments with a fine conducting powder. And then that, I guess, sticks to... you know, they apply an electrical field to the metal. Then they apply the powder, and that, I guess, then it attracts to this slightly corroded pieces of the metal, and then that's how they get the print. And then they use a computer program to piece it together into a real fingerprint. So obviously, there's a lot of interest in applying this technology to the roadside bombs in Afghanistan.
Oh, wow!
Iraq.
Yeah,
if you could just recover enough pieces, you could actually then, you know, link them back to specific individuals. Very cool. I found that surprising. Which means that a new study shows that while wind turbines are a major hazard for birds, they pose little to no risk for bats is fiction, is complete and total bunko. In fact, what the study showed is that wind turbines are more of a risk for bats than was previously thought.
Aww.
Much more of a risk than for birds, although it is a major hazard for birds. You can minimize that by trying to avoid their migratory patterns, their pathways, and maybe turning them off at certain times. But it's still a huge problem for birds, and that's one of the major environmental objections to massive wind energy programs, is that it's a tremendous hazard to any flying creatures. But bats were often overlooked in that a lot of focus on birds. But in fact, studies looking at the dead animals at the bottom of these wind turbines show that the majority of them are bats, that bats are getting hit much worse than birds are.
Oh, poor bats.
Wow.
Hey, bats are really important to the ecosystem. They eat a lot of insects.
Yes.
But you would think that their echolocation might help them. And you guys, had some not unreasonable hypotheses as to why their echolocation might not be saving them from colliding with the blades of these wind turbines. But in fact, it is saving them from colliding with the wind turbine blades. That's not how they're dying. That's how the birds are dying. The birds are dying by running into the blades. The bats are not running into the blades, probably because of their echolocation.
The wind?
not the wind,
the
but you're close, the pressure. They are dying from barotrauma.
I mean.
So they're,
no shit.
Yeah. And the reason, is differences in the anatomy of mammalian lungs and bird lungs.
Whoa.
That mammal lungs are built around these air sacs. And when you have a drop in external pressure, the increased the pressure inside those air sacs in the lungs can cause them to expand and even burst the capillaries.
So they suffocate.
That's right. So they have respiratory failure due to this barotrauma to their lungs. But they don't have trauma from smashing into the blades themselves. Whereas bird lungs are designed differently. They have a more tubular design. They don't have these little air sacs that can expand and cause, you know, capillary rupture or can explode. So they can survive the barotrauma much more. So they're not getting killed by the drop in pressure. They'll only get killed if they actually happen to hit one of the blades.
So why don't they play some sound or something to push the bats away or make some sonar image of like something scary so they fly away?
Yeah, so they have to explore mechanisms to minimize the carnage, you know, around these wind turbines. They're talking, you know, in the articles about, again, maybe avoiding bat migratory patterns. And migratory bats are hit the most. Species that are migratory are being hit the worst.
Bats migrate?
So, there are some species of bats migrate. So good job, everyone but Jay.
Jay, what's up?
But Jay, as a consolation prize, you get to read the quote of the week.
Yeah, I get to read the quote that I found, right?
If you wish.
It's your weekly consolation prize.
It's my constipation prize. Anyway, so here we go. A little bird told me, not bats because the bats are dying. A little bird told me that an upcoming 5x5 may be covering the scientific method. So I was doing some research on the scientific method, and I found some pretty interesting stuff there. There's actually a lot to read about the scientific method, and it has quite a history as well. So I picked a quote from a man called Alhazen, who lived on 965 to 1039, and he was believed to be the first person to use like experimental scientific methods. And he was a prominent Iraqi Arab Muslim physicist and scientist. And he said, or wrote, "Truth is sought for its own sake, and those who are engaged upon the quest for anything for its own sake are not interested in other things. Finding the truth is difficult, and the road to it is rough." Alhazen!
It's very good, Jay.
Yeah, those Muslims had some pretty scientific philosophers, all right up until the point where they said, "Oh, God doesn't want us to think scientifically." Then it kind of
What was the detail, Steve? It wasn't good to use numbers, right?
Yeah, they had a problem with numbers, and
they friggin' invented them.
I know.
that was the problem.
Thanks again for joining me, guys.
Thank you, Steve. Our
pleasure. Thank you for letting us play with you, Steve.
Fun as always.
Mm-hmm. Sounds dirty.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.